The following audiobook contains AI-generated content and may contain errors. MyAudiobooks.ai presents Brexit Border Costs, Trade Friction in the United Kingdom Slowdown. Topic Introduction. Before dawn broke over the United Kingdom on June 23, 2016, the country had one question hanging over it like weather. By breakfast, it had an answer. The referendum result was narrow, but its consequences were anything but. In newsrooms, in ministry corridors, in factory offices, and in port towns where the day began with trucks and timetables, people understood almost at once that this was not only a constitutional event. It was the start of a new economic era, though few could yet see what form that era would take. At first, language sounded simple. Leave, and the nation would take back control. Control of laws, control of borders, control of trade. Yet across the British economy, control had never been a slogan alone. It had been embedded in systems that made everyday commerce feel almost invisible. For decades, firms had relied on the European Union's single market, the framework that let goods move with far fewer routine barriers, and on the customs union, the arrangement that removed many of the border formalities that usually slow trade between separate states. For many businesses, those rules were not ideology. They were the reason a delivery arrived on time, a production line stayed fed, or a small exporter could serve customers in France, Germany, or Ireland without hiring a team of specialists. That is why the debate after the referendum turned so quickly from politics to mechanics. A political decision had been made, but the practical meaning of leaving was still unsettled. Theresa May, who became prime minister later that year, read the vote as a mandate not merely to leave the European Union, but to leave the single market and the customs union as well. That choice mattered because it ruled out softer forms of departure that might have preserved more seamless trade while keeping closer legal alignment. Once that path hardened, the question was no longer whether there would be friction. It was how much friction, where it would appear, and who would pay for it. A later vocabulary of Brexit introduced a few terms that recur like milestones. Article 50 was the legal mechanism that begins a country's departure from the European Union. The Trade and Cooperation Agreement, usually shortened to the TCA, became the framework that governed the new relationship once the United Kingdom was out. And rules of origin, a phrase that sounds technical but carries real weight, meant the paperwork and calculations firms had to provide to prove that a product qualified for tariff-free treatment. In the old system, belonging was automatic. In the new one, belonging had to be demonstrated. A human side of that shift was often felt before the policy language had even settled. Executives delayed investment because they did not know what the rules would be. Importers watched exchange rates and found costs rising. Small exporters wondered whether a shipment to Europe was still worth the effort once customs declarations, certificates, and classification work were added to the bill. A larger company might absorb those burdens. A smaller one might simply decide not to bother. That difference, repeated across thousands of firms, is one of the hidden ways that borders shape economies. The story also has an older echo. In 1846, Robert Peel faced a different argument over openness and protection when he pushed through the repeal of the Corn Laws. Then, as now, trade policy was never only about trade. It divided coalitions, shifted the balance between producers and consumers, and forced politicians to choose whose pain counted most. The 19th century dealt in grain prices and landed power. The 21st century deals in customs systems, regulatory checks, and supply chains. The instruments are different, but the political pressure is familiar. When trade becomes harder, the dispute moves from abstractions into household budgets, boardroom plans, and tax receipts. This audiobook follows that transformation from the referendum night of 2016 through formal departure, through the transition period into the new working reality that began on January 1st, 2021. It looks at how a promise of autonomy became a durable change in the cost of doing business with Britain's nearest and largest trading partner. It follows the invisible work of customs declarations, sanitary and phytosanitary checks, border control models, and documentary compliance, but it does so with an eye on the larger stakes: investment, productivity, wages, prices, and public finances. The central tension is not difficult to state, even if it has proved difficult to resolve. What happens when a country gains more formal sovereignty but accepts more economic friction? Can the freedom to make its own rules coexist with the slower growth that may come from making trade harder? Or, put another way, how much national control is worth if the price is paid in lower investment, weaker trade intensity, and a tighter fiscal room for maneuver? The pages ahead do not ask the listener to begin with a verdict. They ask for something subtler and more revealing. They ask the listener to notice how policy changes travel through real life, not as headlines alone, but as delays, forms, forecasts, and decisions that accumulate over time. They ask what it means when a border is no longer just a line on a map, but a daily administrative fact. And they ask whether Britain's modern argument over Europe belongs in the same long conversation as its older fights over grain, industry, and power. By the end, the listener will have a clearer sense of why one referendum could reshape the practical meaning of trade, why some costs appear slowly enough to be mistaken for background noise, and why the future of British prosperity may depend on choices that are as political as they are economic. The question is not simply what Brexit was. It is what a country discovers about itself when the promise of control meets the arithmetic of commerce. End of introduction. In the early hours of June 23, 2016, the United Kingdom went to sleep with a question unsettled and woke to an answer that landed like a door closing. When the votes were counted, the result for leaving the European Union was narrow, 52% to leave against 48% to remain. Official referendum results published by the UK Electoral Commission in June 2016, together with the UK-EU Trade and Cooperation Agreement implementation documents that took effect in January 2021, trace how that vote translated into a new trade regime built around rules rather than membership. But the Leave campaign, the outcome was not just a change of membership. It was a promise of reclaimed control over laws, borders, and decisions on trade and regulation. Control sounded clean, but it sat on top of a messier reality. Across much of everyday life, cross-border trade with continental Europe had been largely frictionless because goods moved under the single market and customs union, where routine customs checks were not a constant feature of transactions. After the referendum, that promised endpoint still had no single visible timetable. In that gap, uncertainty became tangible. Sterling depreciated sharply against major currencies. For firms that imported inputs or priced products with exchange rates in mind, that move could quickly raise costs and unsettle forecasts. Executives responded in familiar ways. They delayed capital spending, tightened budgets, and put some hiring decisions on hold, not because one specific regulation appeared on a specific day, but because the trading relationship no longer ran on autopilot. In a warm, clear tone, paced slightly slower than conversational, the next stage was defining what leaving would mean in institutional terms. In late 2016, Prime Minister Theresa May interpreted the referendum mandate as requiring the United Kingdom to leave not only the European Union, but also the single market and the customs union. That reading mattered because it ruled out soft Brexit options that would have preserved near frictionless goods trade while continuing to accept supranational legal constraints. Routes such as European Economic Area membership which were often associated with maintaining single market access, were treated as incompatible with the direction of travel. Once that choice hardened, the planning assumption shifted toward a hard border logic. The departure mechanism began in March 2017 when the UK triggered Article 50 of the Treaty on European Union. From there, the country entered a prolonged negotiation cycle. Draft texts, rejected versions, renewed bargaining, and repeated warnings about the risks of leaving without a trade deal in place. Parliamentary deadlock slowed decisions at home, and each round of setbacks intensified pressure to find a workable compromise, while also exposing how much the final package depended on trade-offs that were hard to sell politically. That churn culminated in a change of government and a general election before a final agreement could be secured. Oh, the formal break came on January 31st, 2020, when the United Kingdom ceased to be a member of the European Union. Yet daily life did not switch instantly from one system to another. To reduce the shock while firms prepared paperwork and checks, both sides agreed a transition period during which single market and customs union arrangements continued until December 31st, 2020. Negotiators then worked against an end-of-year deadline, concluding the agreement on Christmas Eve 2020. When the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, or TCA, took effect on January 1st, 2021, the headline sounded decisive: zero tariff, zero quota regime for goods traded between the two markets. But that tariff-free access came with a gatekeeper required. It applied only to products that met rules of origin criteria, meaning that the agreement treated a product as originating within the defined boundaries only if firms could show, through documentation and calculations, that it qualified. Once outside the single market, the economic nationality of a product stopped being automatic and became something that paperwork would have to establish. From January 1st, 2021, leaving the single market also meant the return of administrative barriers that had been absent for a generation. The European Union applied standard third country border controls to United Kingdom exports. On the United Kingdom side, officials staged import controls on goods coming from the European Union, initially delaying many checks to reduce immediate disruption and political backlash. This created a temporary asymmetry. European exporters sending goods into the United Kingdom faced a partial reprieve, while United Kingdom exporters encountered the full weight of the European Union's third country controls. One milestone sharpened the documentary reality of the new border. On January 1st, 2022, customs declarations and upfront tariff payments became mandatory for European Union imports into the United Kingdom. The shift mattered as more than an abstract policy date. It changed cash flow and the rhythm of trading, because importers now had to complete customs entry processes even when physical inspection routes were still being phased in. The more visible build-out came through the Border Target Operating Model, or BTOM. UK government Border Target Operating Model policy documents, published in August 2023, together with rollout updates in 2024, set out how the United Kingdom planned to introduce full import controls in stages, with safety and security measures and sanitary and phytosanitary checks gradually expanding, rather than arriving all at once. Under BTOM, the first phase began on January 31st, 2024, requiring health and sanitary and phytosanitary, or SPS, certificates for categories of goods defined as medium-risk animal products and plants, and high-risk food and feed of non-animal origin. The second phase started on April 30th, 2024, adding documentary identity and physical checks at designated border control posts for those categories. The final phase was scheduled for October 31st, 2024, extending safety and security declarations so that EU imports faced a fuller set of border requirements. For agri-food supply chains, those additions carried a sharper edge. Meat, dairy, and plants are sensitive to delay and temperature control. When inspection runs long, spoilage risk rises, and compliance is not only about paperwork accuracy. It can shape whether a batch can be accepted at all, and under what conditions it enters the country. Even when shipments clear, uncertainty around inspection timing can ripple back through earlier decisions about sourcing and routing. The border story, then, is not simply more checks. It is about fixed and variable costs, and about management time being pulled away from production and growth. Once customs declarations, commodity classifications, rules of origin evidence, and additional certificates become routine, firms often need specialist expertise, including customs advisors, and they invest in systems that can generate correct paperwork under changing conditions. Smaller businesses feel this most acutely because each transaction has less internal staff capacity to absorb the learning curve. The constraint shifts from whether firms can trade to how predictably they can trade. Just-in-time delivery illustrates the mechanism. Just-in-time is the strategy of coordinating shipments so goods arrive hours rather than days before they are needed, which reduces the need for expensive storage. That approach depends on borders operating with enough regularity that crossing times are stable. When customs formalities and physical inspections widen the range of possible arrival windows, firms have to build buffers. Some respond by holding more inventory, which ties up working capital. Others respond by narrowing product lines or adjusting suppliers, trading off variety and efficiency for reliability. By the end of the 2020s, the border had become a central fact of economic life. The constitutional debate and the language of sovereignty shifted over time into millions of everyday decisions made by private firms and public officials. A decade did not produce a single dramatic cliff-edge disruption. It produced accumulation, more paperwork, more opportunities for mismatched classification or missing evidence, more scheduled checkpoint moments, and a steady shift in the everyday cost of trading with the United Kingdom's largest partner. To understand what that administrative reality added up to, the evidence that follows tracks those channels through investment, productivity, wages, and public finances. The transition from daily administrative friction at a physical border to the structural performance of an entire nation runs through one quiet mechanism. Once a country builds a customs and regulatory border with its closest trading partner, it changes the economics of doing business across that line. The change does not arrive as a single shock. It returns transaction after transaction as new fixed costs that have to be paid even when volumes are small, and new variable costs that rise with each shipment, delivery, and compliance step. Together, those costs shrink a set of trades that look profitable enough to bother with at all. For United Kingdom firms, the first consequence is a contraction in effective market size. A smaller, harder-to-serve market weakens the pressure that usually pushes businesses to innovate, streamline operations, and upgrade processes. It also slows the spread of knowledge. Ideas, technologies, and specialized know-how move faster when firms are repeatedly trading, meeting standards, and adapting production to their partners' requirements. When friction becomes routine, that diffusion slows, and productivity growth trends lower over time. That mechanism is not just an abstract account. It sits inside the core assumptions used by the Office for Budget Responsibility when it forecasts the long-run economic impact of Brexit. Its framework rests on the idea that lower trade intensity reduces competition, limits knowledge diffusion, and weakens the efficiency of resource allocation. The result is a long-run fall in productivity of around 4%. The point is not that the economy suddenly breaks. The point is that the losses compound. Resources are allocated less efficiently, firms scale down investment plans, and inefficiencies persist because the outside competitive pressure that would otherwise punish them arrives more slowly. By the early part of the decade, the empirical debate shifted from whether there would be a measurable cost to how large it had become and when it showed up. By early 2025, one of the most comprehensive assessments, combining macro data with firm-level evidence from the decision-maker panel survey, estimated that United Kingdom gross domestic product was between 6% and 8% lower than it would have been without Brexit. It put business investment between 12% and 18% lower, and both employment and labor productivity around 3% to 4% lower. Crucially for the story, the gap was not concentrated at the formal exit date. It built gradually as uncertainty stretched the period of planning, negotiations, and repeated disruption, and as the new post-exit trading arrangements hardened into a more trade-costly routine. Those macro results matter partly because they can be tied back to the same mechanism through which border friction operates. Lower investment is the clearest bridge. When businesses invest less, they buy fewer machines, delay software and process upgrades, and hold back on facilities. That is how a temporary slowdown becomes a persistent productivity problem. The early 2025 assessments are therefore not only about output and jobs today, they describe a system in which the country repeatedly chooses the do less now option, then discovers later that it has lost ground that is hard to regain without new capital, new technology, and renewed competitive pressure. Firm-level evidence helps explain why the investment effect looks so persistent. Surveys of senior business decision-makers repeatedly fed into the same storyline. Uncertainty about future trading conditions and reduced expectations of demand encouraged executives to adopt a defensive posture. Instead of designing new products, expanding into new markets, or pushing on innovation, management attention and budgets were redirected toward Brexit preparation. Compliance processes had to be built, logistics had to be reshaped, and supply chain troubleshooting took up time that might otherwise have supported growth. In other words, the border did not only add cost. It reorganized priorities. That organizational shift matches the visible cooling in physical trade. In the long run, goods exports and imports are expected to settle roughly 10% to 15% below the path implied by continued membership of the European Single Market and Customs Union. The Office for Budget Responsibility's broader view plays the same way, with exports and imports projected to be around 15% lower than they would have been without the trade barriers created by leaving those arrangements. The pattern is symmetrical in both directions because shipping goods out and bringing them in now both require firms to meet the new frictions and comply with the new checks. For a closer look at bilateral trade, comparison models have tried to isolate the Brexit effect from wider global forces by using synthetic controls. One such estimate put United Kingdom exports to the European Union about 16% lower, and European Union exports to the United Kingdom about 24% lower, relative to a no-Brexit comparison path. Different methods can yield different magnitudes, but the direction has been stubborn. Bilateral trade intensity fell, and it stayed lower. At trade decline has also been uneven across firms, which matters for the lived texture of the story. Large multinationals can spread compliance capacity across many shipments and routes, and they often have in-house expertise or established procedures. Smaller exporters face the same compliance steps in per-shipment terms without the scale to dilute them. Customs declarations, rules of origin paperwork, and sanitary and phytosanitary certifications all introduce costs that do not fall neatly with order size. Professional fees for customs handling and minimum administrative compliance costs can be especially heavy for low-value, low-volume trade. For some smaller firms, the arithmetic eventually stops working, and the business response is withdrawal from marginal customers or entire market segments. Friction then forces supply chains to adjust. And those adjustments have their own price. Businesses reroute logistics, stockpile critical inputs to manage delay risk, switch to alternative suppliers, or lean more heavily on domestic sources. Sometimes those workarounds reduce the immediate disruption. Often, they also reduce efficiency. Stockpiling ties up cash and warehouse space. Rerouting can increase lead times and transport costs. Supplier substitution can reduce fit. Once supply chain redesign is underway, it becomes a long-term cost of doing business rather than a short-term transition. The story also runs through Sterling. Immediately after the referendum, the currency fell sharply, and that weaker exchange rate acted like a tax on imports. It raised the cost of foreign goods, raw materials, and components for United Kingdom firms and consumers. In normal circumstances, a weaker currency could make exports more competitive. But Brexit introduced trade barriers at the same time, so the expected export lift was muted by non-tariff frictions and by the administrative reality of trading under new procedures. The result was not a simple rise in prices everywhere. It was steady pressure in parts of the consumption basket that are import-intensive, combined with persistent extra cost in tradable supply chains. Clearly, with a curious analytical tone at a deliberate pace. Quantifying how much of the consumer price story is uniquely attributable to Brexit is difficult, because the years after the referendum layered in other shocks. COVID-19 disrupted demand and supply. Global supply chain bottlenecks pushed up costs across borders. Then the energy price spike added its own inflationary force. The key difference in how economists treat the Brexit contribution is that some studies and policy syntheses see Brexit as an amplifier rather than a sole cause. In sectors where trade costs and supply chain frictions affect delivery timing and sourcing options, the border-related costs can make recovery more expensive than it would have been under peer country conditions. That is where the living standard story becomes less about a headline number and more about channels. With productivity weaker and the economy smaller relative to the no-Brexit path, real wage growth tends to be softer. Paychecks do not stretch by as much as they otherwise might, and the smaller economy produces a narrower tax base, which feeds directly into public spending choices and welfare support. Together, those pressures can make households feel the pinch, even when the mechanism is slow-moving. A weaker productive capacity reduces wage momentum, while tighter public finances restrict how much support the state can offer without taking on more borrowing. The fiscal mechanics are where the promise of a windfall meets the arithmetic of national income. During the referendum campaign, the idea of ending payments to the European Union budget offered a concrete saving. The Institute for Fiscal Studies has drawn the distinction between the mechanical saving from stopping net contributions and the much larger national income effect, which works through any Brexit-induced change in gross domestic product. Under a no-payment assumption for alternative arrangements, the mechanical saving is estimated at around £8 billion per year. But if gross domestic product is 6% to 8% lower than it would otherwise have done, the revenue shortfall is correspondingly larger. The Institute for Fiscal Studies estimated that the revenue consequences could be between £20 billion and £40 billion by the financial year 19-20, enough to wipe out any pre-referendum budget surplus that the mechanical saving had been meant to protect it. In the longer run, that gap implies either higher debt, more fiscal consolidation, or both. When those choices arrive in the real world, they show up as tighter spending trade-offs. One clear example is the National Health Service, not because health policy is uniquely exposed, but because health spending is large and relatively rigid. In the financial year ending in 2024, the Department of Health and Social Care spent approximately £188.5 billion. Roughly 94.4% of that spending went to day-to-day resource use, with most of it flowing through NHS England for salaries, medicine, and routine care. That leaves limited room for capital investment in facilities, equipment, and modern infrastructure. The growth path makes the constraint sharper. Real terms, health spending grew by about 2.3% per year between the financial years 15-16 and 23-24, below a long-run average of about 3.7%. Projections then pointed to real terms growth of about 2.7% per year through the financial year 28-29, still below the historic trend needed to keep up with pressures such as an aging population. The consequence is visible in the backlog for NHS maintenance and capital repair, where underinvestment accumulates rather than disappearing. The government's fiscal problem does not sit only with health. It also carries new and expensive obligations, and one of the most prominent is defense. The United Kingdom has committed to raising defense spending to 3.5% of gross domestic product by 2035. In a larger, faster-growing economy, that commitment might be absorbed with fewer painful reallocations. In a structurally smaller economy, it forces sharper choices across departments. In practice, the pressure shows up as a set of trade-offs. Higher taxes, deeper cuts elsewhere, higher borrowing, or slower improvement in public services. The fiscal dividend promised by the referendum has therefore dissolved into ongoing scarcity management. By the middle of the decade, the economic picture has developed a kind of convergence. Different research routes do not always agree on every number. Business surveys, synthetic comparisons, and structural modeling vary in method and detail. But their ranges increasingly point in the same direction: a smaller economy, weaker productivity, and a tighter fiscal environment than the no-Brexit path would have delivered. As a result, the debate shifts away from what if and toward how to live with and manage a less prosperous reality. That pressure sits alongside Britain's older arguments over openness and protection. To anchor the comparison, we return to the Corn Laws Repeal Act and United Kingdom parliamentary proceedings from 1846, alongside Department of Health and Social Care spending returns for the financial year ending in 2024 and forecast materials published in the mid-2020s. Quinnan had argued before about whether openness was worth the pressure it placed on protected interests. The 19th-century fight over the Corn Laws is the clearest older example. In British usage of the time, corn meant grain, especially wheat. The laws formed a system of import restrictions and duties designed to keep foreign grain expensive, support domestic prices, and defend the political weight of landowners and agricultural producers. That system did more than shelter farming. It redistributed costs and benefits in a way people could feel quickly. When imported grain stayed expensive, domestic grain prices stayed higher than they otherwise would have been. Landowners benefited through rents and the preservation of rural power. Urban households paid more for bread. Manufacturers disliked the arrangement because dearer food put pressure on wages and narrowed the home market for the goods they hoped to sell.
By the 1840s, the dispute had become one of the central political battles of the age. Robert Peel had started as a conservative statesman associated with order and prudence. But the potato blight of 1845 and the broader strain on food supply that followed made the old protection harder to defend. In 1846, Peel pushed through repeal. He did not carry it with a united party behind him. He carried it with support from outside much of his own conservative base, and the party split.
The economic effects of repeal unfolded over time rather than overnight. Cheaper imported grain did not instantly fix every hardship or flatten every food price, because transport costs, harvest conditions, and global market swings still mattered. Still, the direction was clear. Repeal weakened the protected position of landowners, eased food costs for many urban consumers, and suited manufacturers who wanted a more open commercial order. It did not create industrial growth by itself. railways, capital markets, empire, technology, and urbanization all mattered enormously. Yet, repeal aligned policy with a Britain that was becoming more industrial, more urban, and less willing to organize national economic life around landed protection alone. That older story matters because major trade shifts rarely stay inside economics. They split parties and reorganize class coalitions. Peel's repeal fractured the conservatives and helped rearrange 19th century politics for years after. Trade policy forced an argument about whose interests counted most in the governing settlement. Brexit did something similar in a different register. It cut across party lines. It divided business interests from one another. It asked voters to rank legal autonomy, border control, prices, and growth against each other, rather than pretend they fell rose together in the same direction. The comparison also has firm limits, and those limits matter. The Corn Laws were agricultural tariffs and import restrictions in an era when the key argument turned on the price of grain. Brexit's economic border with the European Union is mostly not a tariff story. Under the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, many goods can cross without tariffs or quotas if they satisfy rules of origin requirements. The frictions arrive elsewhere. They sit in customs declarations, rules of origin documentation, export health certificates, safety and security filings, sanitary and phytosanitary checks, and product standards that must be met and proved. A 19th century tariff was often legible on an invoice. A 21st century regulatory boundary is often embedded in time, staffing, software, testing, warehousing, and the risk of delay. Some costs appear at the frontier when a shipment is checked. Others appear earlier when a firm designs a product, chooses components, commissions a certificate, or decides whether a small export order is worth the compliance effort. A Victorian grain duty changed the price of wheat entry. A modern regulatory boundary can change whether an entire supply chain works at all, even when the tariff rate is zero.
That is why the Corn Laws parallel helps more as a political comparison than as a mechanical one. Both episodes concern openness and protection. Both create winners and losers. Both expose the difficulty of holding a governing coalition together once trade policy starts redistributing power at home. Yet, the tools differ. The Corn Laws protected domestic agriculture by making imports dearer at the border. Brexit raises costs through a thicker web of legal and administrative requirements attached to trade with a nearby market that had once been deeply integrated into British production. By the middle of the 2020s, this web had settled into a durability that a long transition language could no longer mask. As the United Kingdom completed the main phases of the border target operating model on January 31st, April 30th, and October 31st, 2024, the system that firms had been preparing for moved from staged rollout into day-to-day operation. It was not a collapse after the darkest no-deal warnings, and it was not a return to frictionless trade. It was a steadier condition of higher trade costs and lower openness than the old single market and customs union settlement had delivered. Once that condition hardens, regional consequences become harder to ignore. A weaker trading relationship does not fall evenly across the map. Places with thinner private investment, larger productivity gaps, or heavier dependence on tradable sectors have less cushioning. When investment weakens, regions with deeper capital markets and dense networks of high-value firms often absorb more of the blow. Regions that were already struggling can fall further behind. Quantifying that pattern is difficult, but some recent modeling makes the scale visible. In work prepared for the Greater London Authority, Cambridge Econometrics estimated that by 2023, the United Kingdom gross value added stood about £140 billion lower than it would have been under a no-Brexit path. That was a gap of 6.0%. The gap widened over time. By 2035,
The projection was that United Kingdom GVA would be more than £311 billion, or 10.1%, lower than in the comparison path without Brexit. Those figures are counterfactuals, not money that can be found missing in a vault. Even so, they help translate a decade of diffuse drag into an economic scale. A smaller economy means fewer profitable projects, fewer upgrades that clear the hurdle rate, and a narrower tax base for the Treasury. It also means that each public promise has to be financed from a weaker underlying income stream than it would otherwise have been. The same Cambridge modeling estimated that the United Kingdom had around 1.8 million fewer jobs in 2023 than under the no Brexit comparison, with a projected gap of nearly 3 million by 2035. That did not imply a single moment when people were dismissed. Counterfactual employment gaps typically accumulate through jobs that were never created, expansions that were never approved, vacancies that never opened, and supplier networks that stayed smaller than they might have become. The human significance is in those narrowed options long before they show up as dramatic headlines. London appeared more resilient than many other parts of the country, and that too is part of the problem. The capital has deep service industries, stronger access to finance, and more capacity to absorb shocks. Yet, the same evidence suggests that Brexit widened the connectivity gap between London and the rest of the United Kingdom. Resilience at the center can coexist with relative weakening elsewhere, because that coexistence is exactly what a regionally uneven shock tends to produce. When the national economy grows more slowly, the strongest places often keep more of their advantage. For a future Chancellor of the Exchequer, the differences stop being sociology and start being arithmetic. A higher growth counterfactual would have left a larger public finance envelope. A lower growth reality leaves a smaller one. Health already absorbs a very large share of that envelope. In the financial year ending in 2024, the Department of Health and Social Care spent approximately £188.5 billion. Roughly 94.4% of that total went to day-to-day resource use, with most of it flowing through NHS England for salaries, medicine, and routine care. That leaves limited room for capital investment in facilities, equipment, and modern infrastructure.
The growth pattern makes the constraint sharper. Real terms, health spending grew by about 2.3% per year between the financial years 15 to 16 and 23 to 24, below a long-run average of about 3.7%. Projections pointed to real terms growth of about 2.7% per year through the financial year 28 to 29, still below the historic growth pace needed to keep up with pressures such as an aging population.
One outcome of that gap is visible in backlogs for maintenance and capital repair, where underinvestment accumulates rather than disappearing. The fiscal squeeze does not sit only with health. It also includes major commitments that arrive with their own cost pressure. Defense is one of the most prominent. The United Kingdom has committed to raising defense spending to 3.5% of gross domestic product by 2035. In a larger, faster-growing economy, such a target can be absorbed with fewer painful reallocations. In a structurally smaller economy, it forces sharper choices across departments. In practice, the Chancellor's table becomes a set of trade-offs. Higher taxes, deeper cuts elsewhere, higher borrowing, or slower improvement in public services. The referendum's fiscal dividend becomes harder to defend once weaker national income reduces the scale of tax receipts and tightens the space available for new spending without larger sacrifices. The political logic stays simple, even when the numbers do. Scarcity is more regular.
One route into understanding this dilemma is to separate two ideas that are often bundled together. The first is sovereignty in the legal and procedural sense, the authority to write rules, strike bargains, and diverge without outside permission. The second views sovereignty in the practical and fiscal sense, the capacity to support higher wages, lower some prices, collect stronger tax receipts, and fund public services with less strain. They are related, but they are not the same thing. A state can gain more room to legislate alone, while still losing some of the economic scale that makes those choices easier to finance. Warmly, with a reflective curiosity, that is where the Corn Laws comparison helps again. In 1846, Britain chose to weaken a system that had favored agricultural protection and to move toward a more open commercial order, even at great political cost to the governing party. In the 2020s, the United Kingdom has made a different kind of choice. It has accepted a thicker border with its largest nearby market in exchange for greater formal autonomy over law and regulation. Each choice defines a domestic bargain as much as it defines an external one. Each tells the country which costs it is willing to bear. The unresolved dilemma can be stated plainly, even if it is hard to resolve. If the United Kingdom continues to prize maximum distance from European Union rules, then it may need to treat slower trend growth as a durable feature of the post-Brexit economy. If it wants to recover some of the lost trade intensity and investment confidence, it will have to move back toward shared disciplines that limit the purity of sovereign discretion. Neither route abolishes politics. Each shifts burdens among consumers, firms, taxpayers, and regions, and each creates new winners and losers inside the country. That is the point at which this decade's economic story meets the next set of decisions in the policy pipeline, where specific regulatory choices determine how much friction remains and how quickly it changes. Suggested further reading. If you'd like to keep reading, a very good place to start is the Office for Budget Responsibility's Brexit Analysis, which explains how lower trade openness feeds through into weaker productivity, smaller tax revenues, and tighter choices on public spending. For a broader and more accessible synthesis, UK in a Changing Europe's Brexit 10 Years On, The Economy brings together the main academic findings on trade, investment, productivity, and the overall size of the UK's economic hick. The Institute for Government's Brexit at 10, The Economy, is especially useful on the practical mechanics of the new border regime, including customs checks, rules of origin, and sanitary and phytosanitary controls, and on why those frictions still matter for firms. If you want the official numbers as they are published, the Office for National Statistics trade bulletins are the best durable reference for seeing how UK goods and services trade has changed over time. For the public finance and living standards side of the story, the Institute for Fiscal Studies and the Resolution Foundation offer clear, nonpartisan reading on the gap between the saved E budget contribution and the much larger cost of slower growth, while also showing what that means for wages and household incomes. And so a regional perspective, Cambridge Econometrics' work for the Greater London Authority gives a detailed picture of how Brexit has affected output and jobs in London and across the wider UK. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.